Radio Verte presents Ahuga by Corey Zimmerman.
Riffraff. Act 4.
Last night I closed my door, same as the night before. I heard a noise and said, who is it? The melody paid me a visit. I said, now don't get gay, what will the neighbors say? I tried my best to act real haughty, see, but that melody was naughty.
Yeller's dead, says Clarence. Why, what happened? I ask, bottle bouncing off the wall and clattering across the brick alleyway. Chomping on a Tootsie Roll, Clarence tells the story. Well, I was sitting out back, looking up at the darn branch with my tooth stuck in it, with Ma hollering, telling me to go on and get in the house, or you break something else. Well, the second I jumped to my dang feet, that old hickory, for no dang reason, fell right over, broke Yeller's chain, nearly flattening him like a toad. Anyhows, Yeller howled to high heaven and ran for the hills. But soon as the old mutt hit the road, four dumb plowed him over just like that, flat as a toad. I'm half speechless, half wondering if it's a flat-out lie. First and final run for the old gal. Such is a dog's life, I suppose. But hell, gotta see the bright side. At least he died free. Anyhows, Paul buried Yeller under the porch before I could get him up in the loft and into the trunk. And hell if he didn't have that old hickory chopped up to bits by noon. Goostein gave him some medicine a while back. Says it'll help him with his devilish ways. Some cocaine or another. Either way, sure has had a wild hair up his ass lately. Ma don't know what to think. Twisting her neck all around, walking weird too. Clarence throws a bottle and pulls a half-melted Hershey bar from his back pocket that leaves a stain, looking like he crapped himself. Again. Snagged it when Goostein wasn't looking, he says. Pa sent me up to get him another bottle of his medicine. Took a nip, not too bad. Wanna try some? He asks, taking a nip from the brown bottle. Why are you always stealing from Goostein? I ask. Just like stealing, I guess. Shatter. Another bottle breaks. Shards in my face. I rub my eye and feel the burn. And guess what? What else? I think. My jar of dead flies is almost full. Yuck, I say as he takes another nip. Sure you don't want to try it? Tastes like metal or something. But it's darn near sweet too. Like a shot of whiskey. No, I'm full, I say. Just chugged a pop. Anyhows, thought to collect ham bones next. But Granny smacked my wrist with her dang wooden spoon. 4 days for the welt to go down. She got one hell of a grip with that old spoon, I tell you what. My mother's baking apple pie today, I say. Granny's cooking ham and beans again. I throw another bottle, but it bounces off the wall as Clarence pokes around in a trash bin. I worry I might go blind in my left eye, but I hope if I ignore it, it'll go away. What you looking for? I ask. Aw, nothing. Just like digging through trash, I guess. I cringe as he buries his arm deep, trying to catch a rat. Damn, he says, and shrugs off the stench, as the rat jumps a good 4 feet in the air and scurries off to the next trash bin for cover. You should come and sit in that old hickory hole with me. I can't, I say. I can't be late for supper again, or my father will have my hide. Apple pie sure sounds mighty fine, he says, finger in his nose. He rolls a booger and holds it up to the light. Hell, maybe I'll start a booger collection. Fill up a whole pickle jar in no time. He sneezes, hacks, and spits. Snorts a big snort, and sticks his finger back in his nose, knuckle high, as I watch in amazement. Caught me a trophy, he says, a genuine smile spread wide across his face. Sole tooth, shining bright as a butter tooth might. Slowly, he pulls out a tough string of snot, 1-2 inches. I can feel it coming up my throat like an earthworm, he says, eyes crossed in joy. 4 inches, 5 inches, and a good foot and a half later, he was dangling a 2-foot snot snake from one finger. He started to twirl it around. Hell, I got me a lasso, he says. I found a dead body, I say. What? No. What? How? Where? And you forgot to tell me? Down in the creek. I don't know. I'm trying to forget about it, I suppose. It had a bullet hole right between his eyes.
Bet it's that dang crook, says Clarence.
No way, he got away, I say, as the snot lasso breaks free and slaps against the brick wall.
Show me, he says. Come on,
he begs, as I look down and kick another bottle. And with a flash, I spot Josephina, brisk by in a purple dress. I gotta go, I say, and sprint down the alleyway after her.
I want to see a dead body,
hollers Clarence.
Hey Oscar, why are you always chasing that girl?
Josephina turns back slowly in front of the flower shop, and I notice her solemn face. Hello, Oscar, she says. Want to get a pop? I ask. No, I'm not thirsty, she says. Want to take a walk? Sure, I guess, she shrugs, but not in that usual way, and her rebozo stays in place. On the tracks near P&O, I kick a pebble that bounces over three good sleepers as the backs of our hands touch in the train yard. That's where Papa works, she says. Arturo, too. Nodding toward P&O as we pass by. But I am not surprised. Everyone works at P&O. Josephina, I'm sorry, I say. Why are you sorry? She asks. I don't know. About the dead body, I guess, I say. Her eyes soften and well with tears as she says, I saw a dead body before. I want to stop and hug her, at least hold her hand, but we keep strolling along awkwardly. When I was little, she says, we lived with mi abuelo in Mexico. He was a judge. One Christmas Eve, he was helping me learn to walk when there was a knock at the door. When my grandfather answered, a man stabbed him to death right in front of me. I don't remember it, but after that, it wasn't safe for us no more. So we left in the middle of the night. We traveled by foot to El Paso. It took many, many, many days, she says. I hate to admit it, but I wonder if not remembering it counts. Because hell, I can't get the dead man's eyes out of my head. Especially at night when I'm trying to sleep. And especially that rotten hole. I dreamed I saw a worm crawling out of it. In Texas, she says, we stayed in a migrant camp. Papa worked in the mines, and Mama watched over Arturo and me during the day. But sometimes people came to the camp to scare us, and we would run off into the desert and hide from them until they left. When we'd come back to camp, everything would be broken, and we'd have to make new tents. And when they came back to burn them, we gave up and slept under the stars. The stars in the desert are beautiful, but it gets really cold at night. Then one morning they came again, but this time they did more. They did bad things, bad, bad things. They started shooting people. There were so many screams and so much banging. Papa tried to get us out of the camp, out into the desert where it was safer, where we could hide in the arroyo like before. And he told Mama to run, holding me in her arms. But then there was a real loud bang, and she tripped and fell on top of me. Papa pulled me out from under her and covered my face in Mama's rebozo. When Papa finally took the rebozo off my face, I didn't see Mama anywhere. I cried for her, but she never came. Later, we went back to look for her, and there she was, lying on the ground right where she had fallen. The buzzards had pulled her guts out, and her eyes. Her eyes, they were empty and dark, and I do remember that. Papa and Arturo buried her under some stones, and sometimes I dream of her alone out there in the desert at night. We've stopped walking, and Josephina trembles in her jaw. She kind of looks up at me, but then away, over at P&O, as tears stream down her face. I try to wipe them away, but she rises on her toes to stand firm on her own. Don't dry them, she says. I step toward her, and she doesn't back away. After a long moment, I can feel her heart beating into mine. I want to say I am sorry, but the cat has my tongue once again. No, the cat has shredded my tongue to pieces. I've never heard anything remotely like what she has just told me. I feel stupid and realize I don't have the words because I'm a spoiled little shit. I decide not even to try to say anything anymore. And as I slowly shake my head back and forth, feeling a fool, Josephina hugs me tight, wrapping her rebozo around me. And I cry. I begin to sob into her shoulder. I am a child, wailing snot, and she holds me like a child and begins to sing softly in my ear. I don't understand the words, but they calm me nonetheless. My weeping turns to sniffles, and my sniffles slow. She removes her arms from my waist and reaches into her basket. I look down through swollen, mucus-filled eyes, and I see she holds a pack of Victorias. Want a candy cigarette? She asks. Sure, I say. Wait, where did you get these?
I ask with one last sniffle to clear my nose. I got them for you, she says, and I smile wide, and for the first time, I understand love. Wow, thanks, I say, stepping from sleeper to sleeper, fingers interlocked. Want to get a pop? I ask, feeling I owe her something in return. Sure, she says as we step off the tracks, puffing on powdered sugar and making our way into town. The storyteller I am, I ask Josefina if she wants to hear a tale. A tale of a town. Sure, I love stories, she says, and with a smile and a genuine skip in her step. Tale of a town. In the spring of 1835, the American frontier was alive with opportunity and promise. Among the many hopeful souls seeking a better life was William Parlin, a young man with a heart full of ambition and dreams. Born and raised in New York, he had long felt the pull of the expanding West, drawn by the tales of fertile land and the chance to forge his own destiny. William's journey began with a long trek across the rugged landscape. He traveled by wagon, laden with supplies, and a few cherished possessions, including a well-worn journal, where he recorded his thoughts and observations. Each mile brought him closer to a new life, but also tested his resolve. He encountered rough terrain, unpredictable weather, and the occasional band of weary travelers, each with their own stories of hope and hardship. After weeks of travel, William finally reached the banks of the Spoon River in central Illinois. The area was lush and green, dotted with wildflowers and framed by tall, swaying trees. As he gazed at the sparkling water, he felt a sense of belonging wash over him. This was the place where he would build a future, he decided. In the summer of that year, William settled near a small settlement that was beginning to take shape. There were only a handful of families, but the spirit of community was strong. He quickly became a familiar face, earning the trust and respect of his neighbors with his hard work and friendly demeanor. He helped clear land for farming, and in the back of his mind, as he shared stories around the evening fire, William had a vision. A vision. As the town began to take form, inspired by his surroundings and the potential for growth, he proposed the name Canton, believing if you dug a hole straight through the center of the earth, you'd end up in Canton, China. As silly as it might have seemed, the name was embraced by the settlers, and soon, plans for a formal community emerged. William and the other settlers organized the first town meeting. Together, they laid the groundwork for a school, a general store, and a church, all vital to the life of the community. William's leadership and enthusiasm inspired others to contribute their skills and resources, and he became known not just as a founder, but as a guiding force in the lives of those around him. As winter approached, the challenges of frontier life grew. Harsh weather and limited supplies tested the resolve of the settlers. Yet William remained steadfast, his optimism a beacon of hope. He organized communal gatherings, where neighbors shared food, stories, and laughter, reinforcing the bonds that held them together until spring lastly returned. Passing through the low part of town, houses stand like tired old friends, paint peeling like memories forgotten, cracked sidewalks weaving through wild grass, weeds pushing through the parched earth, while the distant rumble of a train whispers stories of journeys unmet, souls trapped behind shuttered windows, and with porches that sag, echoes of neglect and the tarnish of time. I see a dirty-faced child glaring as Josefina and I pass by. The dirty-faced child. He peeks through a grime-smeared window framed by the peeling paint of his weathered house. Dark hair, tousled and unkept, wide eyes that barely shimmer with curiosity and a hint of longing. But for what? Smudges of dirt streak across his cheeks, remnants of the dusty yard outside. His expression is mixed of wonder and lostness as he watches the soot-encrusted world beyond, where sunlight sits stale in the air. The cracked glass, cool against his forehead, a thin barrier between him and my life unfolding just outside. a life filled with bicycles and apple pie, adventure and the promise of tomorrow. And at this moment, I see in his eye both gloom anchored to his fate and possibly a spark yearning for the vibrant world beyond. But no, it was but a reflection of the sun beginning to lower in the western sky. I lose sight of the tiny figure caught between innocence and the weight of this unpromising world, and I kick a tuna can, long licked clean of its tuna, and I foolishly mutter, "They say this town is cursed, you know, but it's built on top of an ancient burial ground." "This whole country is cursed if you look at it that way," says Josephina. "The whole world, even." I nod in wonderment, and she has quite a point. "But Canton is different," I say. And I tell her a tale of the curse. The curse. A tale. When William Parlin stepped off the wagon in Canton back in 1835, the crisp autumn air filled his lungs with the scent of promise. He had clutched a worn hammer in one hand and but two pennies in his pocket. But as he surveyed the modest gathering, bustling with life, he had a vision. And with determination etched on his face, he approached his new neighbors, announcing, "I'm a blacksmith," his voice steady despite his uncertainty, "and I want to build a shop." His neighbors exchanged glances, intrigued by this newcomer with nothing but a hammer and a dream. But encouraged by their interest, he set to work. Day by day, he crafted his shop from salvaged wood and iron, the rhythmic clank of his hammer ringing through the streets. And as the forge took shape, word spread. Locals began to stop by, drawn by the promise of tools and horseshoes. With each piece he crafted, William not only shaped metal, but also forged connections, his shop becoming a hub of the community. In the dim light of his blacksmith shop, William Parlin hunched over his anvil, the rhythmic clank of metal filling the air. It was the mid-1850s by now, and the field surrounding Canton, Illinois, stretched endlessly, a canvas of potential waiting to be cultivated. Yet farmers struggled with wooden plows that splintered and broke in the tough Midwestern soil. As William hammered away, a thought ignited in his mind one day. Another vision. A plow that could withstand the rigors of the land. He had seen the farmers toil, their backs bent and hands calloused. And so, he set to work, gathering scraps of iron and steel, driven by the challenge ahead. Days turned into nights as he experimented with different designs, forging and welding, testing each prototype against the earth. Finally, after countless trials, he crafted a steel plow that glinted in the sunlight, strong and resilient. Word spread quickly through the farming community, and farmers flocked to his shop, eager to see his new invention. When they tried the steel plow in their fields, they were amazed at how it cut through the soil with ease, turning hard ground into fertile rows ready for planting. William's steel plow revolutionized farming in the region, and his innovation earned him respect and gratitude from the community. As crops flourished and harvests grew bountiful, the man who had arrived in Canton with just a hammer and 2 cents became a pioneer, forever changing the landscape of agriculture. In that humble blacksmith shop, William Parlin forged not just a tool, but a legacy that would endure for generations. But on cursed soil, the more the buried bones of the ancients were tilled up, the more vengeance simmered in that blackness below. And on a bleak March morning in 1886, the town of Canton was still wrapped in the lingering chill of winter when a thin veil of fog clung to the air, muffling the sounds of the community slowly buzzing to life. The Parlin blacksmith shop standing resolutely at the end of a narrow street, its sturdy facade a testament to the craftsmanship within. Within, the rhythmic clank of hammers on anvils filled the air, mingling with the sharp tang of iron and the warmth of glowing coals. As the sun began to rise, illuminating the dusty interior, a group of skilled blacksmiths worked diligently. Among them was Henry, a seasoned smith known for his artistry and keen eye. He was deep in concentration, shaping a horseshoe, his brow beaded with sweat despite the coolness in the shop. The flickering light from the forge danced across the walls, casting shadows that seemed to move with a life of their own. But lurking beneath the surface was danger. Beneath the surface. A gas line that powered the forge had developed a slow leak. Unnoticed amidst the clamor of tools and the clatter of workers, it wafted through the shop a silent omen of vengeance. And just as the clock struck 10, a loud boom, 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 boom shattered the morning calm as the ancients lashed out. The gas igniting in a sudden, blinding flash, the explosion reverberated through the air like a clap of thunder, sending a shockwave that rattled windows many blocks away. The force of the blast hurled workers against walls and sent tools flying, turning the once bustling shop into a scene of chaos and confusion. Smoke billowed from the wreckage, mingling with the cries of the injured. Henry found himself on the floor, dazed but alive, his ears ringing. Around him, comrades struggled to rise, their faces smeared with soot, shock, and blood. The smell of burning wood and iron filled his nostrils, mingling with the metallic taste of fear. Outside, townsfolk rushed to the scene, drawn by the sound of destruction, and they found the shop in ruins, its roof partially collapsed, its walls crumbling. Rescuers scrambled to pull trapped workers from the debris, their hearts racing as they searched for any sign of life amidst the wreckage. A once bustling workshop now as silent as the dead. Josephina looks back over her shoulder, P&O just out of sight, with an eye of dread, a weight of genuine concern in her step. And then, I say, and tell her another cursed tale. Another cursed tale. On the warm summer evening of May 15th, 1882, Canton was humming with excitement. The air was filled with laughter and the echoing sounds of a traveling circus that had set up its vibrant tents on the outskirts of town. Colorful banners flapped in a gentle breeze, and the smell of popcorn and roasted peanuts wafted through the streets from the high to the low part of town, drawing families and children alike to the spectacle. The circus was the highlight of the season, bringing all the classes together. Acrobats twisted through the air, clowns painted smiles on the faces of delighted children, and the roar of the crowd filled the sky, casting a magical glow over the fairgrounds. But as the revelry reached its peak around 4 p.m. that late afternoon, the atmosphere began to shift. A low rumble rolled through the air, unnoticed by the joyful crowd. The temperature suddenly dropped, and the wind began to stir, rustling the leaves of nearby trees. The ringmaster, with his top hat and booming voice, continued to captivate the audience, oblivious to the brewing storm. And just as the final act, a daring trapeze performance, took to the sky, the winds intensified. A sense of unease swept through the crowd as they looked up to see dark clouds swirling ominously above. And suddenly, a deafening roar erupted, drowning out the music and laughter. The sky twisted, and from its depths, a funnel cloud descended, spiraling down toward the ground. Panic erupted in an instant. Families grabbed their children and ran for shelter, but the tornado was upon them too quickly. The ground trembled as the massive storm tore through the fairgrounds, ripping the canvas tents apart like paper, scattering debris in all directions, horses whining in terror, and the sounds of chaos filled the air. In the midst of the turmoil, a young boy named Tommy clutched a stuffed animal tightly, searching for his mother. He watched in horror as the colorful tents were torn asunder, the once vibrant circus transformed into a scene of destruction. Nearby, the ringmaster shouted orders, trying to help performers and spectators alike find safety. And as the tornado roared through Canton, it left a path of devastation in its wake. Buildings uprooted, trees splintered, and the streets littered with remnants of the circus. Broken wagons, scattered props, and the echoes of laughter now replaced by cries for help that broke the eerie silence that fell over a town laid in ruins. And then, I say, before telling yet another cursed tale. Yet another cursed tale. As the day of May 15th, 1882 wore on, the circus was in full swing, while William Parlin was at work in his shop, when a sudden shift in the air turned the day ominous. The sky darkened, and as an uneasy stillness fell over the shop, whispers of a nasty storm brewing began to circulate. But William, ever the reassuring figure, smiled and said, "Just a summer squall. We've weathered worse." However, nature had other plans. As the winds began to pick up, William's family was at home in their cabin. Back in the shop, William's heart began to pound as he thought of his wife Mary and their children, Ella 10 and a 12-year-old, also named Mary. In the cabin, his family huddled together, fear etched on their faces. Sarah held tightly to Mary and Ella's hand, her eyes wide with fright. "We'll be fine," she said, trying to instill calm in the chaos. But the storm unleashed its fury. Tornado touched down with a deafening roar, a monstrous force that tore through the landscape. The house shook violently, and debris flew through the air like arrows. Sarah shielded her family with her body, whispering words of comfort even as fear gripped her heart. And in that moment of terror, a powerful gust ripped through the home, sending wooden beams crashing down as the world about them crumbled. When the storm finally passed, the skies cleared, revealing a scene of utter devastation. As the workers in the shop, once again in ruin, rushed to help one another, William Parlin was found crushed in the wreckage. Meanwhile, young Mary's corpse was found strewn amongst the debris. The loss struck deep as news of William and Mary's death spread quickly, and the town mourned the loss of its leader. Miss Clancy's poodle is on the porch, peering at us timidly as we pass by, but the hound herself is nowhere to be seen. In front of Gustine's, I search my pockets. "Damn," I say. "Oscar," she scolds me. "I can't find my nickel," I say. "It's okay, I don't need a pop," she says. "We can walk to my house and I'll get another nickel for my mother," I say. "No, Oscar, it's okay. Come on," I say, pulling her by the hand, suddenly excited to show her where I live. We take a left at the bank and walk down Elm, passing Edison Phonograph and Baldwin Pianos.
"Moving,"
grunts a man shuffling under the weight of a Mason and Hamlin. "Hey, let's cut through here," I say, speaking of the alley. "We can go the back way. Anyhow, this is the best gift anyone has ever given me," I say, puffing on another cigarette. "I don't want you to ask your mama," she says. "I have to give you something," I say. "You can give me a kiss," she says with a grin. "What? I can't believe my ears." My heart races as I stop to face her. "A kiss?" I ask. "Well, only if you want to," she says. And before I know it, I'm pulling my lips away from her cheek. "What was that?" she asks. "A kiss," I say. "My brother can kiss better than that." "On the lips, silly," she says. My heart is now beating into my ribcage. She rises on her tiptoes and leans towards me, and I toward her. Oh, wow. Her lips. Her soft, warm lips. Her soft, warm lips. A poem. Soft. Warm lips like petals bloom, with the essence of the sun, a taste of honey, sweet perfume, where dreams and hopes are spun. In every kiss a story told, of love that knows no bounds, a spark of fire, a heart of gold, in her embrace joy resounds. So let the world around us fade, in this moment hearts intertwined, for in her lips a serenade, of love that's pure and undefined.
A hooga!
Come on, give me a break. I'm only 12 years old. Hey, what you doing to that there beaner? A shout echoes from down the alleyway,
Hey, Richie Rich, I'm talking to you.
Yes, Richie Rich. That's what the boys call me at school.
Oscar, says Josefina with concern,
and I quickly pull her by the hand away from the shouting, trying to remain calm as I place one foot before the other. Josefina shuts her eyes tight, trusting my lead.
Hey, Rich boy, you a spick lover?
Oh, shit. It's Jimmy of all people. Jimmy of all people, as previously mentioned, lives on a strict diet of steady violence. I could recognize his hog squeal anywhere. His hog squeal, a poem. In shadows deep, a bully's sneer. His voice like a hog squeal, gruff and queer. With every grunt, he seeks to sting. Yet beneath the bluster, fear takes wing.
Oh, Richie Rich, I'm talking to you, spick lover.
He squeals. I pull Josefina faster as he and his friends come running down the alley behind us. Footsteps in closing.
Hey, Bean Humper, stop. Jimmy just wants to talk to you.
Jimmy's friends scream right into the back of my head.
Get him! Crack!
Wait. I've been here before. By the tightening of your grip, I can tell that you have not. We are well beyond the post office. Your pace slows as we cross Avenue A. West Elm, lined with sidewalks on both sides of the street, must make things confusing. You look up at third-story attics and the windows of third-story bedrooms of homes, fenced with freshly painted pickets. Pearly white, of course. At Avenue B, we dip down into a narrow valley where the houses have classic Greek columns, tall chimneys, and ancient shade trees towering out front. You kick a chestnut, and it hobbles over the fine brickwork. And over the top of a gentle rolling hill, we cross Avenue C, and we've made our way to the land of milk and honey. Down into a more expansive valley, we approach an estate with sprawling acreage of clover behind wrought iron gates of ivy. Set well back, the four-story Prairie School Chateau has two prominent gables and a steep terracotta roof. Its face, a geometric grid of large timbers. Confounding, I can tell. A carriage house and gazebo sit by a small twisting stream, and a bronze plaque on the perimeter wall of river stones that reads, Red Crest. Yes, this is the home of Ulysses Orndorff, your papa's boss. Next, a home with a veranda large enough to play football. A picturesque home. Crisp white, behind a yard of broad sugar maples, Dutch gabled. The house has three red brick chimneys, but one's eye naturally shoots up the front-facing Queen Anne Tower, topped with a cupola, finished with slate, fish-scaled shingles, and copper weather vane. Your belly fills with sour apples, with quite noticeable unease. Yes, I've been here before. I seem to awake from my dream, already on my feet, to Josefina walking me, as she uses her rebozo to wipe spit and blood from my face. I have no memory of the swift bottle that came smashing down upon the back of my skull, as all had gone black with a flash in the twirling of lights. With me lying at Josefina's feet, as she swung her basket wildly at Jimmy and the other boys, who took turns kicking me in the ribs, shouting spick lover, bean humper, eat shit, rich boy, and with an impressively clever play of words for an inbred imbecile, you ain't so spick and span now, are you? As they strip my trousers off my legs, tearing my shirt and undergarments to shreds, and before they pinned Josefina against the wall, they soiled my face with spit and a sole of the shoe. I would have done anything to help her, to stop them from groping her under her purple dress. I would have stabbed Jimmy in the neck with a broken bottle to keep him from feeling her up and down with his filthy hands. I would have broken every bone in their bodies and ripped out their tongues to prevent them from saying all those awful things to her as they took turns groping her breasts. But it had all happened so fast, like a nightmarish dream. Now that I found myself awake on my feet in the high part of town with no idea how I got here, half my size, Josefina holds me up all on her own. My ribs must be cracked, as pain shoots through my lungs, and I can hardly breathe as I struggle to take another step. My mind is lost in a swirl of concussion as she helps my nude, battered body through the high part of town. "Which way, Oscar?" she repeats again and again. "Which house is yours?" echoing through my mind, dehumanized and tremoring, as tears stream like a river from her eyes. She begs of me to focus. "Oscar, which way do I go?" Josephina yells help at a lady planting flowers and a pot on the porch out front of the same giant house. The lady turns to see Josephina walking me up the road, my body nude, for all but a lime green rebozo about my shoulders. "Please help," she yells again. "Oscar!" Running down the pathway lined with roses from our front door, freshly painted brilliant red, the overdoor gilded in gold lettering that reads, "Hawthorne," a name unfamiliar to me. "Oh, my sweet boy, what happened?" asks my mother. "They beat him and took his clothes," says Josephina, out of breath. "Who did?" she cries. "What the hell is going on?" shouts my father from the front door. "Some kids from school," Josephina says, handing me off to my mother's arms. My father storms down the path to look me over and says, "Damn, son, I don't know why you can't get along with the other boys." My mother tells Josephina thank you for bringing me home. "That will be all," says my father to Josephina, who slowly backs away, her belly full with sour apples, with quite noticeable unease. Shoulders bare. "I said that will be all." Cherry Street. My father's growl wakes me through the floorboards. "Cherry Street." Lips undoubtedly wet with whiskey. "Riffraff," he shouts. I don't understand. I hear my mother's soft voice say, pleading for reasoning, as she always has. "What you don't understand, Roxy, is that your son has been playing merry hell in the low part of town with none other than a goddamn spick," he says with a whip of a tongue. "Spick?" she says, puzzled. "The filthy girl that was standing in front of our godforsaken house, wearing nothing but sackcloth and ashes," says my father. "Shh, you're gonna wake Oscar," she says. "What will the neighbors think?" he says. I hear the front door open. "The neighbors?" shouts my mother, losing her composure. "Who? Miss Smith? Or the dog she's walking?" "Why, good afternoon, Miss Smith," she says, before the door slams shut. "You better zip those lips shut," says my father. "Before what?" exclaims my mother, as any following words jam up her throat, lips fluttering uselessly. Nonetheless, she searches for reason and meaning behind such sudden madness. I feel my soul slipping from my body as she comes running up the stairs. I close my eyes and feign unconsciousness. My door creaks open by the inch, and I feel her peering in at me. As it shuts, I take a breath, and with it, the words. "Josephina, can you hear me?" as I try to lift my pounding head and look out the window through swollen eyes, over the sugar maple for the low part of town. "But you are long out of sight, exactly where you are supposed to be." "You need to get that boy off your damn knee," carries up through the floorboards, as the clink clink of ice on crystal slides in under my door. Single malt, a gift from the mayor.